John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, there's no real argument that the U.S. tax code is complex. I mean, it is. The question is, who does that complexity serve? If you have enough money, seemingly, you can hire a fleet of lawyers and accountants to scour the laws for lucrative loopholes and tax avoidance schemes. If you're rich, that is. Some are suggesting that there are actually two sets of tax laws in America, one for the rich and another for the rest of us. Well, today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we'll take a look at this idea and hear from a reporter who researched it and get your take as well. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program this afternoon. 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email. talk@wpr.org is the email address. And look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. My guest is Noam Scheiber, who writes about labor and workplace issues for The New York Times. His piece headlined, "For the Wealthiest, a Private Tax System That Saves Them Millions," was the genesis for today's discussion. Noam Scheiber, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So is there a separate set of private laws just for the wealthy? These books may be kept out of sight. We don't get to look at them. Or, I mean, is that a metaphor?
Part of it is metaphorical. Part of it is literal. And just one correction. It's a tax system that saves them billions rather than
billions.
Millions, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are two big pieces of this. The first is right out in the open in terms of public policy, which is that the tax rates on capital gains and on dividend income are very low, much lower than the tax rate on ordinary income, at least for most people. And that is something that saves the wealthy an enormous amount of money. They typically earn a lot more of their income through capital gains and through dividends than they do through just salary and wages. I think in 2013, which is the last year for which we have data, the very wealthy, you know, the top 400 taxpayers in the country earned about six times as much money in capital gains and dividends as they did in ordinary wages and salary. So most of that income does come in the form of capital gains and dividends.
We're mostly talking about hedge fund managers and things like that here, right?
Yeah, or anyone who sold a bunch of stock or real estate or things like that. Any kind of asset that would appreciate and then you would then sell would qualify for capital gains treatment. You know, that rate is very low. It's around 20% versus close to 40% that you would pay if you were in that bracket for your salary. And it's no accident that that's very low. The wealthy have consistently made the case over the years that it should be low, and they've given a lot of money to politicians who have lowered that tax rate. So even though that's very much out in the open, it is not an accident that that rate is very low. So that's one piece of it. It's a big piece of it. And the second piece of it is a set of tax rules, as you said, a very complicated set of tax rules that can be exploited if you have the right amount of expertise and the right amount of money to exploit them. And as it happens, it's really only worth your while to even try to exploit these rules if you make millions of dollars or actually tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But if you do make that kind of money, it is very worth your while. And I'll just give you one example that we use in the piece. There are many. But one example is if you are a hedge fund manager and you just take the profits from your hedge fund and pay taxes on it in a given year, you will pay about 40%, a tax rate of about 40%, because you are taxed at the short-term capital gains rate, which is that rate. However, if you set up an insurance company in Bermuda, actually an insurer of insurers called a reinsurance company, and you invest your money in that company, which then in turn invests in your hedge fund, those profits will then be taxed at about half that rate, about 20%. And the average person who makes, you know, a five-figure or six-figure salary is not going to be able to do that because it costs a lot of money to set up a reinsurance company in Bermuda, and you need a lot of money to invest in that company. For a very, very rarefied group of people, you can basically slash your tax rate in half if you're able to, in this case, set up an insurance company offshore. There are legions of examples like this, but the thing that they all have in common is they are relatively convoluted, and they require a lot of money before it even makes sense for you to do that. But once you do have that money, it becomes very, very lucrative.
So I want to go back to the differences between capital gains taxes and the taxes that that a wage earner would face. I mean, isn't the rationale that we want to reward speculation? That we want people to make risky investments because that's what drives the economy?
There is some rationale that. There are a couple of reasons that economists over the years have given for having a lower capital gains rate than an income tax rate. One is to reward investment. You need to encourage people to make large investments, and those investments in turn benefit the economy. They create jobs. The other rationale is for certain investments in businesses, those are already taxed. It's a corporate rate, and we have a tax on corporate income, essentially. And so some of those, that money shouldn't be taxed twice, basically. So if you are a shareholder of a corporation, you are essentially paying taxes on the income of that corporation. Why should you then pay taxes again when you sell your share of that corporation?
Okay, hang on. That's, you know, when I read that in the article, I did not understand that at all. So I'd like to just stop there for
sure,
a second,
yep,
and try and figure this out. Because, so I hold shares of stock in a company. We won't name it, but some company, it's a publicly traded company, and they pay a dividend every year. So when I read this in a different article as a justification, you know, say, well, you're taxing this twice. I didn't pay any taxes on that. I got the dividend, which was on the net, which was after taxes. But how am I paying taxes on that share?
Right. Well, I should say that I don't entirely buy the rationale for this, but the argument is, if you are an owner of something and that something is taxed, then it's coming out of your pocket somehow. I mean, the tax man may not show up at your house and demand the corporate taxes from you directly, but if you own an asset, and that asset is and income on that asset is taxed, and somehow then it's going to eventually be reflected. If I own a share of a corporation, and that corporation is taxed very heavily, then that share is probably going to be less valuable than if it were taxed at a light rate. So implicitly, you're shouldering some of the burden of that tax. And so the argument is, if you're already shouldering some of the burden of that tax, we shouldn't tax you again when you go to sell that asset. Now, I don't entirely buy that, but that is the argument. I mean, I think the biggest and most, there are two really compelling counter arguments. I think one is that having this differential, having this this preference for capital gains, essentially encourages and rewards all the gaming that we're talking about, and that gaming is very inefficient, right? If you have a lot of people sitting around thinking, not like, how am I going to invest my money productively and how am I going to create jobs, but how am I going to, reinvent my capital, my ordinary income as capital gains, and what accounting rules can I exploit that will allow me to do that? You're probably not creating jobs while you're sitting around scheming and trying to figure out how to do that. It's a very inefficient activity.
Well, and a lot of this is, and forgive me for oversimplifying it, but a lot of this is people swapping paper back and forth, and it's almost like shuffling a deck of cards, only at the end of the day there's five aces.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. And I think the other thing that that makes this bizarre, to say the least, and suspect, is you often have in the economy people who essentially make their money in the same way. You have a hedge fund manager, and you have a person who runs a fund inside a large bank, and they're essentially doing the same thing. They're managing a large pot of money. They're investing in various assets. They're making similar trades, and yet the person inside the large bank, they are taxed at 40% on that income, and the hedge fund manager, because they're able to redefine their income as capital gains, is able to pay about half that rate. So is often able to pay half that rate. So it's um, it's just a sort of bizarre concept. And I think there's a basic principle of tax law that you should tax similar activities in similar ways, and this violates that principle, in addition to violating a basic norm of fairness, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the political element of this, because these laws are there because Congress put them in place. They wrote the tax code, supposedly. Although I wonder if we conducted a quiz, how many members of Congress would actually understand what's in the tax code?
Right. Yeah.
That was a rhetorical question. But so how did we? How did we end up with this system that rewards people for trading piece of paper back and forth and kind of making up their own rules?
Well, you know, we have this campaign finance system that that allows rich people to give a lot of money to politicians, and even more so since Citizens United. And in the piece, we talk about this nexus between campaign giving and the campaign finance laws. I think it is clearly the case that over the years, a lot of very wealthy people have given a lot of money to politicians who would vastly lower their effective tax rate. And I would say that, again, the biggest source of those savings is probably the low capital gains rate and the low dividend rate, which fell dramatically. It fell first most recently, you know, in the kind of modern era. It fell first in the late 90s under Bill Clinton. The Republican Congress was very aggressive in pushing that, and Bill Clinton signed that bill. And it fell dramatically in 2001 when George W. Bush lowered it quite a bit to down to 15%. And a lot of people gave George W. Bush a lot of money who would benefit from that low capital gains rate. So that is a huge culprit here. But you know, there are a lot of these little deals, like the reinsurance loophole that I mentioned, a lot of things like that, you know, specific industries, private equity, hedge fund managers have lobbied on over the years. There is actually very recently the IRS proposed a rule that would tighten some of these things up, the reinsurance loophole that I mentioned. And the insurance industry has swung into action to try to soften that rule, as you would probably expect it to. And it's not at all clear whether the tightening will happen or how tight the tightening will be.
Well, we hear a lot from time to time about how we're going to crack down on this and crack down on that. And then later on, when we actually go back and look at what they did, it's a lot different. Even Dodd-Frank, we were, after the collapse of 2008, we were going to clean house, and by golly, we weren't going to have to go through this again. And yet here we are, 8 years later, still having the same discussion.
Yeah, look, I would say that power is a function of money, and the people who have a lot of money benefit enormously from these loopholes. You know, the other piece of this that we haven't talked about yet is the IRS. The IRS, on paper, has a mandate to go after and really scrutinize the tax returns of very wealthy taxpayers. They started this task force in 2010, specifically to vet taxpayers with over $10 million in income from year to year. The problem is the IRS is egregiously underfunded. In real terms, it's down over 20% since the Republicans took control of Congress, of the House, in 2011. And the thing you have to understand about auditing very wealthy people is their tax returns are incredibly convoluted, and it's incredibly resource intensive to disentangle all the various, even the various legitimate business dealings of very wealthy people, to say nothing of shell corporations and all kinds of exploitation of loopholes. So if you're looking for another important culprit, the underfunding of the IRS cannot be overstated here.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got some Facebook comments and some emails. Wonder if we could get a few phone calls here. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can call in and talk about this issue. Is this something that concerns you, that we basically have, in effect, if not in law, we have, in effect, two tax systems, one for wage earners and one for the very, very wealthy? And what do you think about that? Is that something we need to do something about, or is that just the cost of having people invest in our economy and we should just leave it alone? Whichever way you happen to think, let us know. 800-642-1234. Noam Scheiber is my guest on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen this week. We'll take a break and we'll come right back. Stay with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about tax law today. Noam Scheiber is my guest. He wrote an article in the New York Times, which was the genesis for this program, about how there seems to be two sets of tax codes, one for the extremely wealthy and another for the rest of us. And we're talking about that, finding out what you think. The phones have filled up, as I knew they would. Let's go to the phones, and we'll talk to Paul in Two Rivers first. Paul, hello.
Hi, John. Yeah, I'm concerned about this issue and have been for many years. When politicians began talking about a flat tax on income years ago, I got to thinking about it, and I thought, no, a flat tax on income wouldn't be fair. But a flat tax on wealth would be fair. And if we can look at the income taxes paid by the median income person and provide a system that today would give them the same tax load, the tax burden on an average person based on an average person's wealth, and then extrapolate that out both down to the extremely poor and all the way up to the very, very rich, I think we would come up with something that's fair and could fully fund the government as needed.
What do you mean by wealth?
Everything. Anything that has value is wealth. So not only cash, but, you know, property. We all pay a flat tax on our property, property tax. But all wealth, and I'm talking about patents, like if a drug company owned a patent that's worth a certain amount of money, then they should pay that because they're being protected by the U.S. government. The wealthy get more from the U.S. government than anybody else, and they're in proportion. They don't pay their fair share for what they get, which includes basically the protection of their wealth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Paul, thanks a lot. Noam Scheiber?
So this idea of a wealth tax is an idea that's come up from time to time, and it's gotten some momentum behind it, I would say, at least among people who think about inequality. Probably the most high-profile proponent of it is Thomas Piketty, the French economist who wrote a very well-received book about income inequality, or income and wealth inequality, I guess, a couple of years ago. I think it has some merit. It is unquestionably the case that the wealthy benefit from enormous kind of social infrastructure that is made possible by by the government and by society writ large. I think one of the challenges with wealth is we know very little about it. People are required to file fairly detailed statements about their income from year to year, but they are not required to disclose the extent of their wealth, whether it's real estate or stock ownership or a variety of other assets, like the caller mentioned, patents, automobiles, go down the list. That is not an accident. The wealthy have long resisted disclosing the details of their wealth precisely because they wanted to resist attacks on their wealth. And so I think it is both a worthy exercise, but probably even more challenging politically and kind of as a mechanical proposition than even raising taxes on income. So I would say it's a good thought, but the wealthy have already beat you to that thought, and they've taken steps to make it very, very difficult to execute.
There've been some Senate hearings on these issues. What did those find? And I mean, what was the outcome?
Yeah. So I mean, this is a topic that comes up in Congress from time to time. You may be referring specifically to an investigation that the Senate, there's a Senate panel on investigations, which conducted an investigation into a particular scheme where hedge fund managers were buying these exotic financial instruments to do a version of what I described at the outset of the program, to essentially convert short-term capital gains, which are taxed at the kind of the 40% ordinary income rate, into long-term capital gains, which are taxed at about half that rate. It's a very convoluted deal. They relied on a couple of investment banks to sell them this financial instrument that would allow them to save literally billions of dollars over a decade from doing this. And the Senate investigation concluded that essentially this was an abuse of the tax system, and one particular hedge fund that had been notorious for using this, exploiting this loophole on its own, the committee estimated that they'd saved about $6.5 billion in taxes over a decade, and that hedge fund, actually Renaissance Technologies, is founded by a guy named James Simons, who's a very prominent Democratic donor, big donor to Hillary Clinton, and it is now run or co-run by a guy named Robert Mercer, who's probably the biggest supporter of Ted Cruz. And so I don't think it's an accident that people who may be looking at a kind of several billion dollars in unpaid taxes would want to invest in politicians who may be able to ease the burden a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think that the practice that Renaissance was involved in is called basketing, I think, isn't it?
It's called basket options, yeah.
Basket options, okay.
They essentially purchase an option on their own investments. And that, by doing that, it kind of magically converts them from short-term gains to long-term gains.
Yeah, the air gets a little thin up there. I have a little trouble breathing.
Right.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Randy in Kewaskum next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Now, you talked about two tax systems, one for the rich and one for the regular worker. What about the third one? Small business owners like me get reamed by the tax code. I pay a heck of a lot more in taxes than my employees do. I work longer hours. I work worse hours. But the government's there to go and ream me royally. And I'm not big enough to have all kinds of ways to hide money the way rich people do. But it drives me nuts to hear people that go and work for somebody else. Oh, they make so much money. It's like, yeah. They should live on what I do.
Randy, thanks. Small business owners also have a gripe. I mean, there's no question that our tax laws are really complicated, and there's a pretty commonly held perception that they really aren't fair.
Yeah, look, I think if you look at the average rate paid by income percentile, you know, you look at the top 400 taxpayers, the top 0.0001%, the top 0.001%, 0.01%, 0.1%. The richer you go in that very high range, the lower the effective rate, right? So you go from affluent people to wealthy people to very wealthy to ultra wealthy. At every step, they pay a lower effective rate. And one way of looking at it is that the ultra wealthy are very good at shifting the burden down to the wealthy and to the kind of merely affluent. And you don't want to cry too much for someone who's making $200,000 a year or $300,000 a year or $400,000 a year. But you can make the argument that if someone who's making $200,000 or $300,000 a year is paying an effective rate of 25% or 30%, then someone who makes $100 million a year probably should pay more, right? Not less. That person who makes $100 or $200 million a year shouldn't be able to shift the burden of the tax burden down to the person making $300 or $400, to say nothing of someone making $50 or $100.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, that's the number to call. Randy, thanks for your call. Let's go to Door County next and hear from Mark. Mark, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. I agree that the tax code is complicated, and we should address it and simplify it. My only concerns are really unintended consequences of that could be hitting the middle class. I come from a middle class family. My wife does as well. And our families invested not a penny in the stock market. They put their money away and they, saved for retirement, but they didn't use the stock market. Now, my wife and I have used the stock market, and we've used real estate, and we've invested. And while we're still in the middle class, I would consider that we're, on the upper side of middle class, and we have benefited from many of these same vehicles. And if capital gains were taxed and changed in order to somehow right a wrong for these hedge fund managers, it very well could impact us as well. And it would be probably more impactful for us than they. And, you know, there's another unintended consequence that we're concerned about is we need these. You know, I work for a publicly traded company, and I need the owners to continue to invest in the company, to continue to invest in the dynamic of the marketplace in a way that, you know, keeps my job secure. So I like that these wealthy individuals took the risk to start my company and continue to take the risk to grow the company. And so, you know, our concerns boil down to making sure that there aren't these unintended consequences that change their willingness to invest and also aren't going to hurt maybe the middle class that are doing a little bit better than the generation before us, you know, than our parents did because of engagement in the market.
Okay, Mark, Ken, before you go, Ken, I just would like to ask you something here. From your perspective, do you see a difference between, say, the publicly traded company that you work for investing in itself, in, say, improving its technology, in whatever, investing in itself, and some other company or bank or fund or something like that using a tax loophole to convert one kind of income into another? Because, you know, which one do you consider to be an actual investment?
Well, you know, I think that both are an investment. It kind of goes back to the discussion you had earlier about whether or not you're being double taxed. You know, in a form you are. And so while one might be more clearly tracked, an investment into research and development that provides me a new opportunity to sell something, that's a very clear investment. Another, you know, they protect, retained earnings that secures the company and makes them a little, you know, has a little bit more cash on hand, even though they haven't reinvested it. That might make a company that's, you know, more likely to retain employees because they have a little bit more secure footing. They're not as, you know, clearly tracked back to a true investment per se, but they both create an environment where I, as a middle class person who works for a publicly traded company, benefits.
Okay. I appreciate you sharing that perspective with us. Noam Scheiber?
Yeah, I would say two things. Let's take each one of those claims separately. The first claim that by raising the capital gains rate, you'd actually raise the burden on the middle and upper middle class rather than the wealthy. The data just doesn't support that. If you look at the way the tax burden falls, it actually falls now pretty heavily on the upper middle class, precisely because there's a very low effective rate on the wealthy and ultra wealthy, and that low rate is driven overwhelmingly by the low capital gains rate. So, in effect, what is happening is because of the very low capital gains rate, the upper middle class income, the income tax rate on the upper middle class is higher than it otherwise would be because they are essentially subsidizing low capital gains rates for the ultra wealthy. So I think the caller has it backwards. He is doing vastly worse as a result of this low capital gains rate. If the rate were raised, he would pay a higher tax on a small portion of his income, but would in theory be able to pay a lower tax on a much higher portion of his income. And precisely because the opposite scenario prevails, the capital gains tax is really low, ordinary income rate is relatively high for him, he's doing a lot worse. So there's that. On the second thing, I think there's very little empirical evidence, and economists have looked at this for years, to suggest that people make decisions about whether to invest in stock, publicly traded stock, based on the capital gains rate. It sounds plausible, but people actually don't base their stock buying decisions on that. There's just not a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that that's happening, and certainly not within the range that we see, that we actually experience from, you know, a low of kind of 15% to a high of the ordinary income rate, you know, which would be sort of between 15% and 35% or 40%. People are just not are just not basing stock buying decisions on that rate.
Well, and what we've seen companies doing over the last 8 years since the economic collapse of 2008 basically has been buying back their own stock and stockpiling cash. It's not like they're investing in hiring new employees.
That's right. No, I mean, you're right. If we were concerned that the inability of companies to sell stock to the public was something that really weighed on companies and was a factor in restraining job growth, it would be hard to square that with a large trend in stock repurchases, right? Like you would want them, you would expect them to be trying to sell this off to the public as frantically as they could, rather than buying it from the public.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the family office, because that one is even after. I mean, I read your article several times. I still don't get it. Maybe I'm just a little dense.
Yeah. So a family office is basically the in-house wealth management department of a very rich family. So within that department, there are people who think about how to invest the money. They think about how to minimize taxes on that money. They think about how to donate that money, which is often, you know, born of noble intentions, but often also has a very prominent sort of tax savings component to it as well. So you, depending on how wealthy the person is or the family is, that family office may include one or two people, or it could include dozens of people. Often the biggest determinant of how large the family office is whether they do their own investing in-house, you know, whether they basically run a hedge fund just for that family, or whether they outsource the investment portion of it to actual hedge funds. For the very, you know, the ultra wealthy, they often do that investing in-house. So there are potentially dozens of people working in that family office.
Now, there are those who say, well, listen, this is you're really talking about the 1% of the 1%. It's a very tiny fraction of all the taxpayers in the country, and we really shouldn't be paying any attention to this.
Well, I mean, it would be one thing if it were a tiny fraction of people that had no impact on the rest of the country, but it happens to be that this tiny fraction of 1% has enormous impact on the rest of the country. They are, as a result of paying, you know, tens of billions of dollars less in taxes, raising the tax burden on everybody else. So I would say that it has enormous impact on everybody, even though it's kind of, the culprits are a relatively small in number.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have more phone calls and Facebook posts and emails and comments to get to. Yours could be one of them. A line will be opening up for you very soon at 800-642-1234. Or you can leave your comment on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Or write an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. My guest is Noam Scheiber, who writes about labor and workplace issues for The New York Times. He wrote an article that was the genesis for today's program. We're talking about tax policy and how it really does seem like there are a number of different tax systems, one of which benefits only those who can afford to take advantage of it. And we're discussing that this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about tax policy. There seems to be two different tax sets of tax code, one for the rich and one for everybody else. And maybe there's a third one just for small business owners. We have a lot of people who want to talk about this. Noam Scheiber is my guest. He wrote the article that caused this program to be booked, and you can call in and ask him a question or make a comment. Richard in Madison, we'll go to you next. And hear what you have to say. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a question, really. When the Glass-Steagall Act was passed during the New Deal, it seems to me things were pretty fair. The Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, was it not, in 1999? And since then, we've had some really bad things happen. Like the Great Recession, and these exotic, you know, capital, what do you call them, securitized instruments that Michael Lewis wrote about in The Big Short. That mm-hmm. wouldn't have come about, would it, had the Glass-Steagall Act been in place?
Richard, excellent question. Scheiber, Glass-Steagall's mainly about banks, wasn't it?
Sure, yeah. This is a little outside the ambit of my piece, but Glass-Steagall basically prevented a commercial bank from merging with an investment bank or an insurance company so that an institution that took deposits from ordinary depositors wasn't then making all sorts of exotic bets in the financial markets. Look, I think there are a legitimate argument to make that not having Glass-Steagall alone is not what caused the financial crisis. There were plenty of standalone investment banks, not commercial banks married to investment banks, that got in trouble and flamed out. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers being two big examples. There are also hedge funds that flamed out that were not a part of large commercial banks. So so you can show pretty easily that just having Glass-Steagall in place would not have solved this problem. I think the place where people who want Glass-Steagall to be reimposed have a very strong point is that we have a handful of very large financial institutions, and their size is partly a function of the repeal of Glass-Steagall. We have Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo. You know, we have kind of four or five mega banks, and their mega bankness was made possible by the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And as a result of being that large, they actually have enormous political power in addition to having enormous economic power, and they are able to use that political power to prevent reforms of the financial system that could have prevented the financial crisis and could prevent a future financial crisis. So I think for political reasons as much as economic and financial reasons, having a Glass-Steagall-like measure in place is probably a good idea.
Well, and I think maybe in Richard's case, the original law that was passed during the New Deal time, the actual tax rates were a lot higher. I think the top rate wasn't as high as 90%, so there were a lot of other things at play there. Let's take another call, and this time we'll go to Appleton. Steele is on the phone, and Steele, go ahead.
Yes. Last night or early this morning, I was online, and Glenn Greenwald has a paper called The Intercept, and he helped bring out Snowden, all that. And the article was, ha, 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 Clinton's top financial supporter now controls The Onion, which is sort of a crazy little paper out of Milwaukee. And it's owned by the owner of Univision, and I never knew his name, I can't, but it's Chaim Saban. He has a wife, Cheryl, and I was looking at it, and so he wanted to buy, you know, L.A. Times, this and that, and work with Disney. He started out as a cartoonist, and he's one of the biggest donors to the Clintons. And then when things get crazy, and nothing wrong with Jewish, but he's Jewish, and he was with the military, and his staunch supporter. That he gets involved in the politics, and that's all fine and dandy. But so I clicked on, and a New Yorker article talked about all the troubles he had with how he has to play with his money. But anyway, Mr. Univision and.
So what is, I mean, relate this to what we're talking about here, about the apparent different tax codes for the rich as opposed to everybody else.
Well, I'm not a quick reader. I'd have to read it a few more times. But, yeah, he didn't go to jail, and he would send someone off to jail.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how that applies here. Noam Scheiber, you want to take a shot at it?
I'll pass.
you identify in your article supporters of both Democratic and Republican candidates for office as being people who have used the current tax code to their advantage. I mean, you weren't playing any favorites here. Clearly, everybody who's who's got a lot of money has a stake in seeing public policy favor them keeping it, that it would be counterintuitive to suggest otherwise. So it's not just a Republican or a Democrat issue. Both supporters of both parties have been pretty active in this area, haven't they?
Yeah, unquestionably the case. This is much more a function of wealth and income and your economic interests that flow from those. It is absolutely the case that it's a bipartisan phenomenon. I mentioned earlier two partners in a very prominent hedge fund, Renaissance Technologies, one of whom was a longtime Democratic donor, one of whom was a very prominent Republican donor. You see that across the board. Mr. Saban has definitely had some run-ins with the IRS over the years. He is a Democrat. He is a prominent Hillary Clinton donor. It is just unquestionably the case that you see this on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, no one can say for sure why people donate to politicians. I can't say for sure why Mr. Simons has given a lot of money to congressional Democrats and Hillary Clinton over the year. I can't say for sure why Mr. Mercer has given a lot of money to Ted Cruz. I can't say for sure why Mr. Saban has given a lot of money to Hillary Clinton. But it is the case that they have economic interest, and particularly in the case of Mercer and Simons, potential tax liability that are sort of pending before the government. So
perhaps what we need is a change in the tax code so that the benefits that accrue from political influence could be taxed as long-term capital gains.
Yeah, it's one way to do it. Though, as your earlier caller who proposed the wealth tax suggested, if you had a wealth tax, then that would actually cover those benefits too, right? Because anything that happened to increase your wealth would be subject to the wealth tax.
Well, if I go to Las Vegas and I put $1,000 on 29 black and it comes up, I have to pay a tax on the difference between the bet and what I made.
Correct. Yeah.
There would be some who might suggest that a lot of the speculation that happens on Wall Street is really pretty much the same thing, only dressed in a little nicer suit.
Yeah, well, that is the case. I mean, there is this feature of the tax code that taxes short-term capital gains at the ordinary income rate. So for wealthy people, if you're doing a lot of speculating, so you have a hedge fund and you're placing a lot of short-term bets that a lot of people would liken to gambling, well, that is actually taxed at the higher rate, at the kind of close to 40% rate. But the game among people who place a lot of short-term bets is to then convert those short-term bets into what the Internal Revenue Code considers long-term bets, even though they're actually short-term, so that you can pay roughly half the rate. So, so it's in principle, those should actually be taxed at a pretty high rate, but in practice, people are very good at finding ways to pay the lower rate on them.
Let's, Steele, thanks for the call. Let's go to Claire in Madison next. Claire, hello.
Hi, John. Thank you. That was an excellent point you just made, by the way. This whole thing really upsets me. There's a pervasive attitude in this country by certain people that people that are on disability or Social Security or food stamps or whatever the government program, they're just a bunch of leeches and losers and, you know, mooches off the society. And meanwhile, we've got these unfathomably wealthy people that are taking advantage of the rest of us and using our tax dollars for infrastructure that helps their corporations, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just so unbelievably unfair and not right. And they're on welfare, if you ask me. They're mooching.
Okay. Claire, we're starting to run out of time, so I'm going to let you go. But, Noma, that's probably a pretty commonly held viewpoint about the unfairness of the system.
Yeah, no question. There's a lot of frustration about the unfairness, and frankly, it is hard to understand why, as I said, when you go from kind of affluent to wealthy to ultra-wealthy, the effective rate actually falls. I think that is counterintuitive to most people, that someone who makes a couple hundred thousand dollars a year would pay in the upper 20s, but someone who makes a couple hundred million dollars a year would pay below 20% and oftentimes below 15% of that in taxes.
Mm-hmm. We had a comment from someone who emailed in and said millions of middle-class taxpayers are invested in the stock market through their retirement accounts, that ultimately they will pay taxes on gains at the ordinary rate and not the capital gains rate. Is that the case?
Ultimately, they'll pay the ordinary rate, not at the capital gains rate. I guess I'm not entirely sure what they mean by that. I mean, if you... if you buy stock and sell it, then you pay the capital gains rate. There are sort of vehicles that allow you to like an IRA that allow you to do a lot of this stuff tax free. But I'm not sure. What
okay.
they mean by saying
well,
that.
we'll leave that discussion for On Your Money with Kevin McKinley on Tuesday mornings on the Ideas Network. Lois in Madison, let's hear from you next. Hi, Lois.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering how we can expect a tax code change from the Congress when most of the Congress people are millionaires and benefiting from the tax code, which I'm not sure they do. But how can we expect them to change the tax code when they are benefiting so much by the present tax code?
Lois, that's a great point. Let's let our guest respond to that because we're starting to get short of time. So why should we expect any change? A lot of millionaires in Congress, they'd be voting against their own self-interest.
I think any member of Congress who happened to be a millionaire would tell you that they make these decisions entirely on the merits. They make them with a pure public policy and kind of public interest rationale in mind. But we all know that that people's economic interests shapes their thinking in subtle and not so subtle ways. So it would be hard to believe if someone sitting in Congress looking at a piece of legislation that would raise their own tax rate dramatically weren't in some way affected by that, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to try to get another quick phone call in here from Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, you'll have to be quick because we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Okay, really quick. I agree with everything about the loopholes for the high-income folks, but I think they're out there for the average guy as well. If you take a family of three, make $60,000 a year, you're over 55, you can bury about $23,000 into a 401k, that brings it down to $37,000. You can take your standard deduction for $12,000. You can take your personal exemptions for about that much more. So the 24 leaves you about 11 or 12 left. And if you can still put it into your IRA, you can have a zero tax rate because you can do $6,500 for you and your wife.
Okay. I want to let the guest respond. I'd like to meet the family of three with a $60,000 income that had $20,000 to invest, but Noam Scheiber?
Yeah, look, there are unquestionably tax-preferred vehicles that are available to everyone in theory across the income spectrum. But your point is the right point, that most people don't have that extra income to exploit these tax vehicles. But if you make hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you don't need to live on the vast majority of that, and you can mm-hmm. play with the rest of it. Just one thing that your previous caller did mention, or the question about paying the ordinary rate, they might have had annuities in mind, and when you receive distributions from an annuity, you do often pay the ordinary income rate. So that's
yep.
what they had in mind.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know what, we're out of time. I really appreciate you being with us today, though. This has been a very informative hour. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
Noam Scheiber writes about labor and workplace issues for the New York Times, and we appreciate him being a guest on the Kathleen Dunn Show today. K.P. Whaley produced this hour of programming and also handled on-air production as well. And the always talented Michelle took care of some technical things for us. Appreciate her and all of you for listening and calling in and sending your emails and making those Facebook posts. Couldn't do it without you. We'll have another hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show coming up next. We're going to talk about private prisons and how powerful a lobby this has become, almost without any notice from most of us. We'll discuss that after the news coming up. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.